I wish I was talking about ego networks and XDR registries. Those sound very exciting. But I am not. But I am excited about the work that we're doing. I'm the interim acute and communicable disease section manager, and I also manage the HAI program for Oregon. I have a little bit of an identity crisis at this point because of my multiple roles, but hopefully that'll get sorted out soon. Our healthcare-associated infections program started off probably like a lot of yours, focused mainly on... Oh, you can't hear me? Hello? Can you hear me now? No?
Maybe a reminder, too. It's a big room, small screen, so feel free to come.
All right. Can you hear me now? Okay, so our healthcare-associated infections program started off like most healthcare-associated infections programs, focused on surveillance and NHSN reporting. I got into this field originally because I'm interested in the idea of preventing people from getting sick and dying in hospitals, so I'm really happy to say that we're rapidly moving more and more to active outbreak response and prevention efforts. Now, this is a picture of our healthcare-associated infections program, and I'm actually pinch-hitting for the person in the lower left. Her name is Kate Ellingson. Unfortunately, we are losing Kate. She's moving on to other pastures. I don't know if they're better, but other places. But we have a wonderful team here, and I will continue on. So one of the main things that we're focused on in Oregon is trying to prevent the spread of antimicrobial resistance. And as you know, antimicrobial resistance consists of both existing concerns, like MRSA, and then also emerging threats such as carbapenemase producers. And most recently, we're particularly concerned about MCR1, which you might know confers colistin resistance. And so the combination of carbapenemase production and colistin resistance is pretty concerning because you end up in a situation where you have potentially totally untreatable infections. We're also concerned because we have few antibiotics in the pipeline and increasing risks of transmission with these plasmid-mediated mechanisms, and then also increasing evidence globally of transmission. So that's one of our main focuses. And I think you've already seen this slide like 50 times here, but I'll present it again. We are very much interested in the idea of a coordinated, integrated approach where the state health department kind of serves as a nexus and works with hospitals that serve as these hubs, that with the long-term care facilities and other facilities where they have a lot of transfer. And we are, one of the main benefits of this kind of system is that it promotes increased interfacility communication. And the reason that you're interested in that is I think that one of the main ways MDR was traditionally got spread was that people move between different settings and the information was not appropriately communicated, and then you don't put appropriate infection control in place, and then that's, you have a prime way to get transmission. So I think this kind of approach hopefully is one of the answers, and we are seeing that, in fact, here's another slide that I think you've seen before. But coordinated approaches appear to, it looks like over the span of about 5 years, the prevalence rate for CRE maintains a fairly low rate if you use a coordinated approach, whereas if you use no intervention, which you might suspect, you're going to have a pretty dramatic rise. But also if you use these independent facility interventions, you have a pretty dramatic rise in MDROs. I come from Oregon, which, like Alaska, I think is a very beautiful northwestern state. We have amazing coastlines, mountains, deserts, and I'm happy to say that we have pretty low resistance. Now, this is relatively speaking. We have about 33% compared to 46% nationally. And kind of interesting, this is right around the same time as we started our statewide effort in 2012. We actually see a dip in antimicrobial resistance. So I don't know if that's a coincidence, but I'll take it. So the statewide effort that we have is called Drop CRE. That comes from Drug Resistant Organism Prevention Coordinated Regional Epidemiology Network. This is a statewide effort that includes multiple different stakeholders, such as our hospital association, nursing home associations, representatives from all major health systems, pretty much anyone that we think would potentially have a vested interest in preventing the spread of CRE. is working together on this effort. Now, the way it works is we have an advisory committee where all these people come together a couple times a year, but then we also have a core group where we meet monthly, and then we meet much more frequently if we actually have a carbapenemase producer. So we have active surveillance for carbapenemase production via laboratory surveillance, and if we identify a case, we immediately descend on the facility like a strike team with our suits on. No, actually, this is just, we call up the facility, and then we work with them to try to see what we can do to try to identify any potential transmission and prevent any further transmission. So that would be screening cultures, contact precautions, et cetera. One of the things that we've done is we've created our own Oregon-specific guidance. So this is our Oregon Drop CRE toolkit. And then we also have webinars, educational meetings, et cetera. Now, we saw that one of the biggest concerns that we had in Oregon was we just see that there's really poor communication between medical facilities. So we're trying to figure out what we can do about that situation, because, like I said, I think this is one of the main ways that these organisms have spread probably in the past. And we looked into the idea of kind of these voluntary situations where you promote a form or work with people to see what you can do to make it happen on a non-legal level. And unfortunately, I think there's just too many disincentives for that situation. That's my perception, at least. So nursing homes usually basically kind of work with what the regulation requirement is. And then hospitals, they need to discharge patients, and then they're concerned about patient rejection. And so I think a lot of times they actually, whether I'm not sure if it's a conscious thing or not, but we're not communicating the information appropriately. So we made this requirement in 2014 for a communication during patient transfer. And it includes all facility types, acute, ambulatory, long-term care settings, and dialysis settings. And they have to notify receiving facilities of any MDRO or infectious disease requiring transmission-based precautions. And the notification has to be written and clearly accessible. Now, this is a template form, but we don't focus on the idea of a specific form. And the reason being that we think that going forward, more and more facilities are going to have electronic communication. And so rather than focus on specific forms, we focus on the idea of specific information that needs to be transmitted. Now, in the short term, we're very aware that a lot of these electronic systems are not in place, so we provide example forms that people can use. Now, the objectives here, so I wish we had an XDRO registry right now or some wonderful way to really assess what's going on, but we don't have that yet. But our initial information here that I'm presenting is from a survey that we've conducted, and this is self-reported information, and I'm going to present some information that has comparison by facility type and also share some lessons learned, including implementation challenges and steps moving forward. So there's a couple different surveys. The first one was a hospital survey that was done in 2012 and then repeated in 2015. This is not required, but we still had high participation levels. And we're looking at what information hospitals obtain about patients admitted directly from another facility, and then also in implementation of the law. And then in 2015, we had another survey. This is for skilled nursing facilities. And again, this is looking at implementation questions. And this one was actually required by law. Our analysis, again, this is survey data, so we pretty much mainly are doing descriptive analyses, looking at self-reported implementation of the law, methods of compliance with the law, and facility perception of other facilities' compliance. And we did the chi-square test for statistical comparisons, looking at variation by facility type. Now, the participation levels, I was extremely impressed with this, that we got 97% of hospitals to fill out a survey that is not required. So I attribute this to our HAR program's valiant efforts working with APIC and just reaching out in general. I think we have really good positive relationships, which is a big part of this kind of integrated coordinated approach. Nursing facilities, 140 out of 140 filled it out. That's 100%, but this was actually required. And then 95% of them answered the IFT-related questions. I don't think it's because they specifically were choosing not to answer those questions. I think it's more that this is a 20-page survey, and these were kind of towards the end of the survey, so I think it's more survey fatigue. Now, interestingly enough, I think that conducting this survey in and of itself has actually increased awareness of the law. So 12% of SNFs and 10% of hospitals were previously unaware of the law, and so I would think that after they've answered this question, pretty much 100% of facilities have some kind of awareness. And then we also see compliance, which is what we're really looking for here. Before the law was 23% of SNFs and 31% of hospitals were appropriately communicating information. But now we have 72% of SNFs and 83% of hospitals. So at least on a self-reported level, we have pretty high levels already of compliance. And then notification of any kind, we see an even better data here, with 92% of respondents agreeing that they are doing some form of communication. Now, I think the reason that there's a difference between the last slide is because a lot of this communication might be happening on a verbal level instead of a written notification, which is what the requirement might be or is. Now, this is where I think it's kind of interesting. So basically, everyone thinks they're appropriately communicating to the other facilities, but they do not necessarily think that the facilities are communicating to them appropriately. So 38% of hospitals here and 53% of SNFs agree that transferring facilities are appropriately notifying them. Now, I was comforted to see that we have a lot of administrative support. 88% facilities report some level of administrative support, and that's 92% of hospitals and 86% of SNFs. And this is kind of, to me, like the really important part is what are people actually doing with this information? Because the idea is you want to actually identify MDROs and prevent the spread of MDROs. And so we see that 24% of SNFs and 48% of hospitals are using a form, and 17% of SNFs and 34% of hospitals are using an MDRO-related field for actively identifying MDROs. Now, I think the actual percentage of some kind of use of this is a little bit higher than either of these questions, because it's actually, unfortunately, it was a multiple response question, so it's hard to figure out exactly what the percentage was, but I think it's a little bit higher. And then we also see that from 2012 to 2015, so that's before and after the law, pretty much doubled the percentage of people that are in hospitals that are using this form, so from 24 to 48%. Now, I think that, to me, the biggest struggle is just under-resourced settings in general, such as long-term care. And one of the things here is just you have tremendous turnover. These facilities just, I mean, it's hard for us even to track their addresses or know how to contact them. So you have all this turnover, and then you also have a lack of expertise within SNFs. So only 8% have CIC certification. And then we're doing all this work that I think is great, but they're not necessarily accessing it. So 31% have used our toolkit, 15% have looked at the website, and 9% had looked at one of our presentations. Now, I think last year we actually were aware that there's this kind of a problem with this, so we're reaching out more and more to these communities and working with the regulatory bodies involved with long-term care. So I think that this has probably all increased fairly dramatically, but it's hard to know. So moving forward, I think we need to focus on a better understanding of how to monitor and look at compliance. We need to make sure that appropriate communication happens to the right people within the facility. So it doesn't matter if you get the information transferred to someone there, as long as if it doesn't get transferred to the infection control people that are actually going to do something about it. We also need to better understand the different methods and forms and electronic methods that are the most useful, and deal with this whole concern about patient rejection. And so in terms of evaluating requirements, I wish we had an MDR registry or an XDR registry. So the idea would be that facilities could automatically ping the registry and then put appropriate infection control in place. The thing that I'm worried about, which I'm trying to mention, was what long-term care facilities are going to be doing in this kind of situation. Like, how do we get those electronic systems that are really not there for some of these under-resourced settings in place? And that's what I still haven't figured out. I don't know if you guys have an answer yet with that, but
next.
Anyways, well, and we want to look at the idea of periodic chart audits. We've done some initial work with that, but I think we need to set up a statewide system where every year we audit a certain number of charts and just make sure we have appropriate compliance. And I'm almost done. And then the last thing here is a couple things. There's an MDRO toolkit. So we consistently from ID physicians hear that there's a concern that, you know, what is an MDRO? You want us to transmit this information, but CDC says one thing, and all these different groups say different things about what MDROs are, what specific definitions there might be for specific MDROs, and also what you're supposed to do in response. So when do you stop contact precautions? Now, I think a lot of times I think people focus on the idea of we need to get the best, you know, completely perfect information. I'm not convinced that's the answer, because I think if you wait for that, you wait forever. I think that we need to kind of use a best guess and on some level and come up with a straightforward plans for people. And the last thing is continue building relationships and educating to decrease concerns about patient rejection. We've noticed that when we work with long-term care facilities and really let them know what's involved with dealing with someone with CRE, then it really helps to make them more comfortable with accepting patients. Thank you very much.
Looks like we have someone coming to the mic. While they're doing that, I guess I'll warn you all that we have time for two questions. Sorry for beginning. Also, just to mention that the speakers will, I'm sure, make themselves available when the session ends.
No, I'm going home.
Okay, sorry, take it away.
Hi, thank you. That was a really interesting presentation. I was wondering what sort of education you do with your facilities when the law was passed to sort of get the awareness out about the form and, you know, just the new requirements, sort of what you guys did in that.
Yeah, so I mean, we work closely with the long-term care regulatory groups, as well as they're kind of these overall, or what do you call them, kind of like a hospital association, but we have a couple of these groups. Leading Age is the one for nonprofits, and the OCA is the one for long-term care associations. So worked with them to get the word out, and then we also had our own webinars, and then worked with APIC. So basically webinars and such.
What sort of challenges did you face in passing this bill? What sort of opposition did
you? You know, I had people that would kind of express some things to me that they said, I felt like whenever I actually just discussed with them and said, well, they'd say, well, what about patient rejection? I'm like, well, you know, you can't just pretend that, okay, you could keep swiping things under the rug forever, but it's kind of just discussing things with people seemed to actually work, you know? It seemed like that solved it. So, I mean, we did get a lot of kind of initial things in that direction, but we didn't get as much pushback as I expected.
Thank you very much.